With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you're listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage, and here's a little music to get us started off tonight.
Time.
today we have for you a few stories with some Frankensteinian senses about them. Mice that can smell light, chip implants that can help the blind detect objects, growing livers in the lab, and a story about when your hand has a mind of its own, high oxygen levels, and monster dragonflies, the real science of Frankenstein and merging humans with machines. In tech news, we see the new cell towers installed on Mount Everest so you can tweet your way to the top. Rover gets stuck in the mud with some interesting discoveries. Did you know that Earth-sized alien planets are pretty common? Well, we have a report on that, and some new cool stuff about the Sphinx, and a possible time traveler caught on film? We'll let you be the judge of that. Bred mice that can smell light? Well, a group of scientists have genetically altered mice so they could smell light. That is, that their neurons responded to light in the same way they do to an odor. This allowed them to study the brain's response without having to deal with the complications associated with smelling. Now, the approach the scientists used to help the mice, quote-unquote, smell the light is called optogenetics. The method uses light to control actions within other specific cells and is broadly applicable. The results were detailed online October 17th in the journal Nature Neuroscience. Now, the coding for smell. The noses of mice and humans are chock full of sensory neurons that respond to scent molecules that waft by. The odor information gets sent to the olfactory bulb, which is a part of the brain above the nasal cavities where the sensory neurons meet up with relay neurons. These two types of neurons then meet with structures called glomeruli. Now, if you look at two cells receiving input from the same glomerulus, they are just passing it on in the same way, or is there more to it? This is what study researcher Venkatesh Murthy from Harvard University, who collaborated with others at Harvard, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and in India. Now, a mouse has about 200,000 relay cells, with between 60 and 100 connected to each glomerulus, or hub. Identifying pairs of relay cells that connect to the same glomerulus is difficult because when a rodent catches a whiff of something, multiple glomeruli go into action. According to Graham Lowe, a neuroscientist at the Independent Monell Chemical Senses Center, who was not involved in the research. He just had a little extra to add. Substituting for odor. But dealing with light is simpler. The researchers genetically engineered mice so that their wiring got crossed in a sense. They added a protein to the mouse smell systems that responds to blue light. So using tiny spots of light, the researchers were able to turn on quote-unquote specific hub structures and record how relay cells responded. Using light to stand in for smell in this way is a quote powerful and promising approach, Lowe said. It's nice to be able to feed a very well-defined controlled pattern into the olfactor bulb. He cautioned, however, that the study did not show that mice can perceive light as odors. Now, the experiments revealed that sister relay cells, which received input from the same glomerulus, did not send out the same signals. Instead, sister cells sent signals that were timed differently. Now, if you want to read more about that, again, you can look it up in the online edition of Nature Neuroscience, dated October 17th. Now here's a cool story about an implanted chip that is allowing blind people to detect objects. This story is about a man with an inherited form of blindness, and he's been able to identify letters and a clock face using a pioneering implant, according to these researchers. Mika Terho, 46, from Finland, was fitted with an experimental chip behind his retina in Germany. Success was also reported in other patients. Now, this chip allows a patient to detect objects with their eyes, unlike a rival approach that uses an external camera. Details of the work are in the Journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Professor Eberhard Zrenner of Germany's University of Tübingen and colleagues at a private company called Retina Implant AG initially tested their subretinal chip on 11 people. Some noticed no improvement as their condition was too advanced to benefit from the implant, but a majority were able to pick out bright objects, Professor Zrenner told the BBC. However, it was only when the chip was placed further behind the retina, in the central macular area, in these three people, that they achieved the best results. Now, two of these had lost their vision because of the inherited condition retinitis pigmentosa, or RP as it's usually called, and the other was because of a related inherited condition called choroideremia. Now, RP leads to the progressive degeneration of cells in the eye's retina, resulting in night blindness, tunnel vision, and then usually permanent blindness. The symptoms can begin from early childhood. Now, the best results were achieved with Mr. Terho, who was able to recognize cutlery and a mug on a table, a clock face, and discern seven different shades of gray. He was also able to move around a room independently and approach people. In further tests, he read large letters set out before him, including his own name, which had been deliberately misspelled. He soon noticed it had been spelled in the same way as the Finnish racing driver Mika Hänninen. One was M-I-I-K-A, and the other one is M-I-K-A. Three or four days after the implantation, when everything was healed, I was like, wow, there's activity, he told the BBC from his home in Finland. Right after that, if my eye hit the light, then I was able to see flashes, some activity which I hadn't had. Then day after day, when we started working with it, practicing, then I started seeing better and better all the time. Soon Mr. Terho was able to read letters by training his mind to bring back the component lines that comprise the letters together. The prototype implant has now been removed, but he has been promised an upgraded version soon. He says it can make a difference to his life. Of course. And what I realized in those days is that it was such a great feeling to focus on something, he said. Even having a limited ability to see with the chip, it will be good for orientation, either walking somewhere or being able to see that something is before you, even if you don't see all the tiny details of the object, he said. Now, this chip works by converting light that enters the eye into electrical impulses which are fed into the optic nerve behind the eye. It's externally powered, and in the initial study, it was connected to a cable which protruded from the skin behind the ear to connect with a battery. The team are now testing an upgrade in which the device is all contained beneath the skin, with the power delivered through the skin via an external device that clips right behind the ear. This is by no means the only approach being taken by scientists to try to restore some visual ability to people with retinal dysfunction. This is also called retinal dystrophy. A rival chip by U.S.-based Second Sight, it's a different company that's here in the U.S., that sits on top of the retina, has already been implanted in patients. But that technique requires a patient to be fitted with a camera fixed to a small pair of glasses. Now, charities gave the news of the latest work with a cautious welcome. David Head of the British Retinitis Pigmentosa Society said, "It's really fascinating work, but it doesn't restore vision. It gives people signals which help them to interpret." Okay, well, if you want to know more about that, of course, you can go to those proceedings in Royal Society B for this month, October. And in other biological news, more Frankensteinian ideas, miniature livers have been grown in a lab. Scientists have managed to produce a small-scale version of a human liver in the laboratory using stem cells. The success increases hope that new transplant livers could be manufactured, although experts say that this is still many years away. Now, of course, they always say this. The team from Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center presented its findings at a conference in Boston. Now, UK experts said that it was an exciting development, but it was not yet certain that a fully functioning liver was possible. The demand for transplant livers far exceeds the number of available organs, and in recent years, research has focused on ways to use cell technology to support failing organs in the body, or even one day replace them. Their building block is the stem cell, a master cell which can, in certain conditions, divide to produce different types of body tissue. However, constructing a three-dimensional organ from stem cells is a difficult task. The method was used by the Wake Forest researchers and other teams around the world, which is to form new liver tissue on a scaffold made from the structure of an existing liver. In this case, a detergent was used to strip away the cells from the liver, leaving only the collagen framework which supported them, and a network of tiny blood vessels. Now, the new stem cells, in this case immature liver cells and endothelial cells, to produce a new lining for the blood vessels were gradually introduced. After a week in a bioreactor which nurtured the cells with a mixture of nutrients and oxygen, the scientists saw widespread cell growth within the structure and even signs of some normal functions in the tiny organ. Professor Shay Soker, who led the research, said, quote, "We are excited about the possibilities this research represents, but must stress that we're at an early stage and many technical hurdles must be overcome before it could benefit patients. Not only must we learn how to grow billions of liver cells at one time in order to engineer livers large enough for patients, we must determine whether these organs are safe to use," unquote. UK researchers welcome the findings, which are being presented to the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases. Professor Mark Thurs from Imperial College London said the results were encouraging. The report suggests that the authors have overcome one of the major hurdles and created an artificial liver to generate functioning human liver cells in a natural liver structure. It is clear that the cells are growing well, but the next step is to show that they are functioning like normal human liver tissue. Dr. Mark Wright from Southampton University also added, "In an era of increasing liver disease and death with a chronic shortage of liver transplants, this represents an exciting development in an important field of work." The researchers appear to have made the major step of combining the stem cell technology with bioengineering as the first step of producing artificial livers. Whilst off-the-shelf new livers are clearly still a long way off, Now, this work is giving us a glimmer of hope that this is no longer just the stuff of science fiction. Now, why would I choose a Michael Jackson remake for a Frankensteinian broadcast? I don't know. Go figure. It just happened to be randomly on my desktop. Now, the science behind Frankenstein. Moving along, the science that inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein is nearly as strange as the novel itself. Written in 1818, the book was influenced by a scientific view that ushered in the first battery and our modern understanding of electricity. The story begins in the mid-18th century. Electricity had captured the imaginations of many of Europe's top scientists, and at that time very little was understood about the nature of electricity. Scientists could generate static electricity by using spinning machines, but it was not until Benjamin Franklin's famous kite experiment in 1752 that they proved that lightning was of the same essence. At the University of Bologna in Italy, noted surgeon Luigi Galvani was investigating the effects of electricity on animals. It was not an unusual line of inquiry. Now, researchers knew electrical shocks produce violent spasms and speculated that electricity might cause muscular contractions. On January 26, 1781, while dissecting a frog near a static electricity machine. Galvani's assistant touched a scalpel to a nerve in its leg, and the frog's leg jumped. Galvani repeated this and several other experiments, observing the same violent muscle spasms. He also noticed that frog legs occasionally twitched when they were hung from a brass hook and allowed to touch an iron trellis. So, Galvani joined a length of each metal together to form a brass and iron arc that made the muscles contract when touched. But where did the electricity come from? Galvani, who thought it was animal electricity, believed it resided in the frog itself. He thought that the bimetallic arc merely conducted the electricity from one part of the frog to the nerve, causing the leg to jump. He published his findings in 1791 and, as the story goes, came to be known as the frog dancing master. One of Galvani's earliest readers was Italian physicist Alessandro Volta. Volta already had earned an imposing reputation as the discoverer of electrical capacitance, potential, and charge, and was also discovered as the first to isolate methane gas. He replicated Galvani's experiments and helped popularize his work. Yet Volta reached very different conclusions. He believed that the electricity came from the two metals used in the arc, and that the frog's leg was acting as the conductor. Within the year, he replaced the frog's leg with a brine-soaked paper, detected a current, and challenged Galvani. The scientific world divided into two camps, animal electricity versus dissimilar metals. The feud became bitter, and at one point, Volta told to a friend that his opponents wanted him dead. "I'll be damned if I oblige them," he added. In 1799, Volta invented the voltaic pile, a stack of disks of two different metals separated by brine-soaked paper. Brine, if you don't know, is salt water, okay? A lot of salt in that water. Very thick and very goopy. The galvanic or voltaic cell was the world's first battery and the progenitor of automotive lead acid batteries that we know today. Okay, today we know that Volta's stack worked because of dissimilar metals transferred electrons in an oxidation reduction reaction, and the frog's legs move because electricity plays a role in muscular contractions. Of course, it would take many decades to work out the details to reach this level of understanding. So how in the world did this influence a young Mary Shelley and lead her to compose of the most widely read novels of all time, Frankenstein or The Modern Prometheus? Galvani's nephew, Giovanni Aldini, was a fierce partisan of animal electricity, yet he did not ignore Volta's pile. Aldini used it to tour the capitals of Europe and demonstrate the medical benefits of electricity or not. His demonstrations involved jolting corpses with electricity and making decapitated criminals sit upright. Woo, that must have been something. Aldini's most famous exhibition took place in 1803 at the Newgate Prison in London, UK. He inserted metal rods into the mouth and ear of the recently executed corpse of murderer George Foster, which was called the Newgate Calendar. A book of the criminals of Newgate Prison described what happened next. Quote, "On the first application of the process to the face, the jaws of the deceased criminal began to quiver, and the adjoining muscles were horribly contorted, and one eye was actually opened. In the subsequent part of the process, the right hand was raised and clenched, and the legs and thighs were set in motion." Unquote. Now, not surprisingly, some observers thought Aldini was bringing Foster back to life. Ah! So Mary Shelley knew all about Galvani, Volta, and Aldini, of course, and because it was big talk back then, it was a very small city, and Europe was all on fire with this debate. Anybody who tells you that science is boring just needs to look at this one little capsule in history and see that it really isn't. Humphrey Davy and William Nicholson, the era's leading electrical researchers, were friends of her father. That's how she had a lot of inside information. In 1816, at the age 19, she spent the summer in Geneva, Switzerland, with Lord Byron, yes, the author, and her future husband, Percy Shelley, a friend of his. The season was cold and rainy, and they spent many evenings around the fire, reading German ghost stories and discussing electricity's potential to reanimate corpses, of course. It must have seemed like she was merely peering into the future to imagine that one day a Victor Frankenstein might succeed in reanimating an assembly of body parts. This story was provided by Inside Science News Service.
Oh, Frederick, are you all right?
Yes. Would you excuse me for 1 minute, dear?
Oh, of course, Doctor.
Igor? May I speak to you for a moment?
Of course.
Sit down, won't you?
Thank you.
No, no, up here.
Oh, thank you.
Now, that brain that you gave me, was it Hans Delbruck's?
No.
Ah, good. Would you mind telling me whose brain I did put in?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
Abby someone.
Abby who?
Abby Normal.
Abby Normal.
I'm almost sure that was the name.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5 foot long, 54 inch wide gorilla?
What?
Is that what you're telling me? Quick, quick, get him up!
What? Three syllables, yes?
I wonder who that could be at this hour.
Now, in the future, it has been predicted that we will be combining metal working parts with humans to create a new age of bionics. Will your children live to see man merge with machines? Will it save or destroy us? Last week, historian Ian Morris revealed how, at the end of the last ice age, a simple accident of geography gave the West the advantages that led to dominating the world for the past two centuries. His argument forces us to accept that our success had nothing to do with superior brains, leaders, or culture, but that the East is on the brink of taking over. That idea may be hard to get used to, but Morris says it will be easy compared with the astounding changes in technology and health that are just around the corner. Now, when we imagine what life will be like in the next century, many people worry about the rise of the East and how it will affect our lives in the West. They may not bother. The reality is that by the year 2100, our planet will have changed out of all recognition, and even the concept of the East and West may be just meaningless. Now, in an interview in 2000, the economist Jerry Rifkin suggested that, quote, our way of life is likely to be more fundamentally transformed in the next several decades than in the previous 1,000 years, unquote. But this is, in fact, an understatement. By most calculations, social development will rise twice as much between now and 2050 as in the previous 15,000 years, and by 2100, it will double again. By 2100, we can anticipate cities of 140 million people. Picture Tokyo, Mexico City, New York, Sao Paulo, Mumbai, New Delhi, and Shanghai all rolled into one. We should imagine armies with five times the destructive power of today's armies, which probably means not more nuclear arms, but weapons that make our intercontinental ballistic missiles, bombs, and guns look as obsolete as the machine gun made the musket. Robots will do our fighting. Sounds like a movie. Cyber warfare will be decisive. Now, this is already going on. Now, technology will turn everyday materials into deadly weapons. The 20th century took us from hand-cranked telephones to the internet, and the 21st will probably see everyone, at least in rich nations, gain instant access to the world's information, their brains networked in all the same way as, the Borg? Hope not, or into a giant computer. The Borg. Now, all of this, of course, sounds like science fiction, or science fact, we don't know. Cities of 140 million surely could not function. Nano, cyber, and robot wars could annihilate us all? And merging our minds with machines, well, we would cease to be human. And that, I think, is the most important point. Now, when most people were young, back in the warm glow of the West Golden Age, they used to watch TV shows like Star Trek, Warp Drive, Phasers, and Scotty beaming up Captain Kirk, and that was cool. But it was a brilliant image of what in the distant future might look like is if we could use that technology while keeping everything else the same. Now we know that's probably not what's going to happen. Now, there were 70 TV shows like The $6 Million Man, and probably came closer to the mark of what really is going to happen. You might remember the voiceover in the opening credits. We can rebuild him. We have the technology. 40 years on, we really are rebuilding ourselves. We actually began the rebuilding a century ago when science and industry gave us first chemical fertilizers and tractors, then the electric pumps to bring water to dry fields, and finally genetically modified crops. I don't even want to get into that. More food changed what it meant to be human. Earth's population has quadrupled in the 20th century, but the food supply has grown even more. On average, all over the world, people are 50% bigger than they were in 1900. We are 4 inches taller and have more robust organs and carry more fat in rich countries, too much fat. Europeans and Americans live 30 years longer than their great-grandparents and enjoy a decade or two before their eyes and ears weaken and arthritis freezes their joints. And in most of the rest of the world, lifespans have lengthened by a closer to about 40 years. And even in Africa, plagued by AIDS and malaria, people lived 20 years longer in 2010 than they did in 1910. Now, the human body has changed more in the past 100 years, like we just said, than it has in the past previous 100,000 years. Our lifespans and general health, not to mention our easily available augments such as hearing aids, artificial joints, Botox, and Viagra, would have seemed like magic to anyone who lived in an earlier age. Probably would have gotten burned at the stake, too. Now, but the changes over the next 100 years will be even greater. The cutting edge shows up in some unlikely areas, such as the sports field. When Tiger Woods needed eye surgery in 2005, he asked himself an obvious question: why be content with what nature gave me? Instead of settling for a merely perfect 20/20 vision, he upgraded to a better-than-human 2015. In 2008, the International Association of Athletics Federations faced an even more extraordinary question. It temporarily banned the sprinter Oscar Pistorius from the Beijing Olympics because his artificial legs seemed to give him an edge over runners hobbled by real legs. In the end, Pistorius missed qualifying by 0.7 of a second. By the 2020s, middle-aged people in rich countries might see farther, run faster, and look better than they did as youngsters. But they will not be as eagle-eyed, swift, and as beautiful as the next generation. Genetic testing already offers parents the option of aborting fetuses predisposed to undesirable shortcomings, and as we get better at switching specific genes on and off, designer babies may become an option. Why take a chance on nature's lottery when little tinkering can give you the baby that you want? Some say that this is eugenics and gone bad. Whether or not driven by racist maniacs such as Hitler or by consumer choice, it could be wrong. In an ethical sense, this is debated on a daily basis in many circles of science and also not science. All of this talk of transcending biology is merely just quote-unquote playing God. And to that, Craig Venter, who just this year justified his nickname as Dr. Frankencell by synthesizing JCVI-SYN 1.0, the world's first artificial life, reportedly replies, "We're not playing." Future shock? Brave New World? Well, if you want to read more about this, DARPA's Silent Talk Project is working on implants that will decode proverbial electrical cells within the brain and send them over the internet so troops can communicate without radios or email. Look that up. One recent National Science Foundation reports is suggesting that network-enhanced telepathy could become a reality in the 2020s. Are you kidding? Network-enhanced telepathy? You know what that is? It's reading memes. There are programs that read nothing but memes on the internet, and trends evolve, and there is predictive software now that can look at future trends, and a lot of businesses are utilizing this information to target certain demographics. Obviously, it all comes down to the bottom dollar now, doesn't it? Now, as early as next year, IBM expects to have an array of Blue Gene / Q supercomputers running that will take us a quarter of the way towards a functioning simulation of a human brain. Some technologists, such as inventor Ray Kurzweil, insist that in the 2030s, brain scanning will allow us to upload human minds onto machines. What? Kurzweil calls this the singularity. Sound like the Borg to you? Does to me. A stage of history when change becomes so fast that it becomes instantaneous. Well, I don't know, my browser isn't always instantaneous, but let's not go there. I have suggested that while geography drives social development at different rates in different parts of the world, rising levels of development also drive what geography means. Okay, so as that changes, other things change. Now, talking about Kurzweil's singularity, if it comes to pass, development will not just change geography's meaning, it will rob geography of meaning altogether. Things are altogether changing. Like I said, 100 years in the future, completely different. The 21st century is generating an alarmingly similar pattern as it has as far back as 2200 BCE, when the expansion of the Old Kingdom of Egypt and the Akkadian Empire is what now is Iraq. It's triggering another package of migration, state failure, famine, and plague, ushering in collapse of a dark age. Now, in each case, the upheavals coincided with rapid climate change, which complicated reactions to crisis. All right. Now, not a year goes by now without the World Health Organization warning of some new pandemic, flu, AIDS, SARS, spreading like wildfire and threatening to kill tens of millions. Meanwhile, the climate is changing faster than at any time in the past 12,000 years. The worst effects are being felt along a great swath from Central Africa to Central Asia. Now, what does this all mean to you? Guess what? Parts are going to go bad, parts are going to go wrong, parts are going to get diseased, and what do we have to replace them? Technology. So, if you wonder if your children are going to end up with metal parts, for the most part, there's not going to be anybody who's just born perfect and stays that way all the way to the end. We have false teeth, we have hearing aids, we have prosthetic limbs, and you know what? It is a brave new world. Welcome to the world of Dr. Frankenstein. Now, here's something cool. I saw this report a long time ago on a special news magazine that was on television about the alien hand. I believe it was on PBS when I saw this report. And it's when one hand develops a mind of its own. You know that saying the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing? Well, for people with a strange disorder called alien hand syndrome, that's literally true. It's a neuropsychiatric condition, and it makes them feel as if one of their hands has taken on a mind of its own. An alien hand is an arm and hand that moves when a person to whom that arm belongs does not intend for it to move, says Dr. Ken Heilman, a neurologist at the University of Florida College of Medicine in Gainesville, Florida. Heilman goes on to note that there are many neurological conditions that cause an arm to move unconditionally, like seizures or tremors, and movement disorders such as chorea, dystonia, and athetosis. But here's the difference. In each of those cases, now the arm moves, it's pretty much just flailing about purposely. But with an alien hand, the movement appears to be purposeful. Creepy. Heilman recalls one patient whose hands actually fought over fashion. Her right hand took a pair of shoes right out of the closet, and her left hand, the alien hand, pulled the red shoes out of her right hand and put them back and picked up a pair of blue shoes. Okay. When it makes a long time getting ready in the morning. When the right hand went again for the red shoes, the left hand slammed the closet door on the right hand. Whoa! It's some violent alien hand going on there. A German neurologist and psychiatrist named Kurt Goldstein was the first to report a case of alien hand syndrome in 1908. His patient's left hand seemed to do whatever it pleased, including at least once an attempt to throttle its owner. Yikes! It's most commonly the result of an injury to an area of a brain called the corpus callosum. Now, the corpus callosum, which is, as Hellman describes it, the major cable connecting the two hemispheres, this injury often happens during surgery, such as an attempt to curb seizures, but it can also happen in stroke victims. That injury prevents the two hemispheres from communicating, and because each side controls different behaviors and different hands, the confusion begins. Usually it's the left hand that is thought to be alien, because that is the one controlled by the right hemisphere, and the left hemisphere has no control over that hand, but it does control language, which gives a person the words to think, what is happening to my right, to my left hand? I don't even know what I'm saying now. Right, left. It's very confusing. Can you imagine what it must be like for these people? And it's always an alien hand, never an alien leg or foot. Now, that's something I thought of right away. The brain has more bilateral control over the legs than it does the arms, Heilman explains. The hand is this thing that does purposeful movement, he says. We don't do a lot of this with our feet. In one recorded case of alien hand syndrome, while a 67-year-old man slept, his hand did not. As a 1997 Medical Journal article reports, his hand, quote, crept and crawled, especially at night, which caused him to awaken by grasping his collar. He solved this problem by wearing an oven mitt as he slept. Okay, but the guy had it easy. According to a 2000 Journal article, a 73-year-old man's alien hand had a humiliating favorite hobby. Well, let's not go into that. This is kind of like a family show here, as gross as it can get. Another more common but less creepy version of alien hand syndrome is an uncontrollable grasp reflex. Now, this causes a patient to reach out and grab whatever it is in front of him, just like a baby would. It's caused by an injury to the frontal lobe, which suppresses that grasping reflex as we mature. Alien hand syndrome is an extremely uncommon phenomenon, and most physicians have never even heard of it, although there is video of it, because I saw it on that PBS show, says Heilman, who has seen only two patients exhibiting the more extreme kinds of symptoms. No, I'm saying that I saw it on the PBS, not Heilman. I interjected that. But it's popped up from time to time in pop culture. The condition is known as Dr. Strangelove Syndrome, and it's named for the titular character in Stanley Kubrick's famous film of 1964, in which Dr. Strangelove's right arm repeatedly tries to give a Nazi salute. He must beat it down again with his left arm. More recently, 30 Rock's live episode on October 14th took on the spirit of the alien hand idea, featuring John Hamm in the two fake Saturday Night Live style commercials for hand transplants gone totally wrong. Now, the late 1990s horror flick Idle Hands also nodded to the creepiness of the uncontrollable hand concept, unless you two were a 14-year-old 8th grader in 1999 with a giant crush on Devon Sawa, you probably don't remember that one. Anyway, in the real world, there isn't anything that can cure or even treat alien hand syndrome, Heilman says. I don't know if they've tried hypnosis, but it doesn't say that in this particular report. Patients usually come up with a creative way just to keep their own appendages in check. I had a patient who just sat on his left hand. Yikes, he says. But many others treat their alien hand as if it were a disruptive child. You can read more about Dr. Heilman's work on his website. Now, in another creature feature monster story, high oxygen levels are spawning monster dragonflies. Biologists have grown super-sized dragonflies that are 15% larger than normal by raising insects from start to finish in chambers emulating Earth's oxygen conditions 300 million years ago. The research presented November 1st at the Geological Society of America's annual meeting in Denver, Colorado, provides more support to the idea that big ancient animals and high oxygen concentrations were not coincidental. It may also offer an instrument to help gauge Earth's ancient atmospheric conditions. No one has been successful growing dragonflies under controlled lab conditions before, at least not to my knowledge, said paleobiologist John Vandenbroeks of Arizona State University, who is also the leader of this work. This has allowed us to ask the question, how have oxygen levels through time influenced the evolution of insects? During the Paleozoic era, around 300 million years ago, huge dragonflies zipped around with wingspans stretching more than 2.5 feet, dwarfing modern relatives, which are the ones we see today. Back then, however, the planet's atmosphere had roughly 50% more oxygen today than today. Now, to explore the effects of ancient oxygen levels, Vandenbroek's team raised 11 other quote-unquote living fossils, including beetles and cockroaches, in three habitats with different oxygen concentrations, one at the late Paleozoic's 31% oxygen level, another at today's 21%, and the third at a 12% from 240 million years ago, Earth's lowest oxygen level since complex life exploded onto the scene half a billion years ago. Now, what they found is that the dragonflies and beetles grew faster as well as bigger and in a high oxygen environment, while cockroaches grew slower and remained the same size. All but two bug species grew smaller than normal at the low concentrations of oxygen. Now, all these measurements and particular specifics of this fantastic lab experiment are found online in several different areas. You can look up in Science Daily. You can look it up on Wired.com under their Wired Science, and you can see pictures of these incredible animals and how truly huge they really are. And they're also studying, of course, the effects on their metabolism. So more to come on more creature features and our Frankenstein idea, which is not so far off the mark and not so far out of the sci-fi genre. It's now science fact, not science fiction, peoples. Oh, arg, it looks like we're out of time, and there's so many more things that we need to talk about. Tech news, and rover, and alien life, and alien planets, and all kinds of things going on in the outer space, and NASA, and we will do that next week, because we don't have any more time. You know, time waits for no man, no woman, no beast, no monster-sized dragonfly or alien hand. So we're under the constraints of the clock, and we will have to say sayonara for this week. And I would like to thank Nick Palucco for the great show graphics, for Dennis Baum and Hawk Production for the fantastic intro that I use every single week. And I hope you all have a wonderful week. Keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails.
I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. It's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
Finally, someone let me out of my cage. Now, time for me is nothing, cause I'm counting no A's. Nah, I couldn't be there. Nah, you shouldn't be scared. I'm good at repairs, and I'm under each snare. Intangible, bet you didn't think, so I command you to. Panoramic view, look, I'll make it all manageable. Pick and choose, sit and lose, all you different crews. Chicks and dudes, who you think is really kicking tunes. Picture you getting down in a picture too. Like you lit the fuse. You think it's fictional, mystical, maybe. Spiritual hero who appears in you to clear your view when you're too crazy. Lifeless to those, the definition for what life is. Priceless to you because I put you on the high shit. You like it? Gunsmoke, you're righteous with one token. You're psychic among no possess you with one though.
I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. Ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on.
The essence, the basics, without it you make it. Allow me to make this childlike in nature. Rhythm, you have it or you don't, that's a fallacy, I'm in them. Every sprouting tree, every child of peace, every cloud and sea. You see with your eyes, I see destruction and demise. Corruption in the skies from this enterprise. Now I'm something to your lives through rust, so not as muscles, but percussion you provide. For me as a guide, y'all can see me now cause you don't see with your eye. You perceive with your mind, that's the end. So I'ma stick around with with Russ and be a mentor. Bust a few rhymes of mother comes and remember what the thought is. I brought all this so you can survive when law is lawless. Feeling sensations that you thought was dead. No squealing, remember that it's all in your head.
Hey, it happened. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, not for long. The future is coming on. Hey, it happened. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, not for long. My future is coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. My future is coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. My future is coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. My future.